This week on the show is championship weekend, a perfect scenario for football fans. What you can expect on Sunday, plus the Celtics still fighting with each other as they try to fight back to the top of the Eastern Conference, and calling it goes Hollywood. All that and more coming up. Calling it starts right now. All right, championship weekend edition of Calling It. I'm Alex Barth. As usual, I'm joined by Alex Lebowitz. We're powered by CLNS Media. I've been doing the show for I started it about 3 years ago, almost to the day, or almost 2 years ago, Lebowitz. This is the third January I've been doing the show. It is the third championship weekend I have been doing the show. It is the third time the Patriots have been covered by the show on championship weekend. Life is certainly good.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're a Pats fan, you can't help but be happy, especially given how the Patriots are playing in the middle of the season. They waited a while to have their best game of the year so far, and last week they definitely did not disappoint.
Look, I don't want to say this show is the reason they made the Super Bowl every reason I've done this show. I don't want to say that's the reason, knock on wood, for this year, but it's, you know, can't disprove it. We got a great game on the other side, too, with the Rams and the Saints, and that's going to be outstanding. And you kind of got the old guard versus the new guard. Similar narratives in both games. You know what? Let's switch it up a little bit, because Nick Gelso, the podcast guru, the man behind CLNS, does tell me that the national focus for the podcast sometimes skews a little better. Let's start with the Rams and the Saints, and then we'll get into the Patriots and the Chiefs second. How about that for a curveball? This is going to be a fun game. I think this has the potential to be more so from a neutral perspective of a fun game than the Patriots and the Chiefs. I think you certainly have more star power in this game. And I'm very glad it's the early game, because, you know, if the Patriots lose, and I never watched the NFC Championship if the Patriots lose the day one. So you get to watch it, enjoy it, really take it in. And I think it's just going to be an outstanding showing of football in low key. Could end up being a defensive battle.
Yeah, I mean, that's been a theory that's been sprouted around. The fact is, last time these two teams played, what was the combined score? 80 points?
It was up there, yeah.
Ridiculous. Whatever the over-under was, they crushed it. And both Drew Brees and Jared Goff were on their game, and I believe that one was also in New Orleans.
It was.
So this could be a completely different one. When you have two teams that have already played each other, you're going to see a lot of changing in regard to that game plan. And both teams have a decent run game. So maybe that's where they go to start this one, and it could be a defensive bout. I still think there's going to be some spots, or each quarterback's going to pick their spots. But the reality is, the Saints, the past few weeks, the last half of that season, their offense wasn't as potent as it had been in the past. And if we're going defense against defense, I think you have to give the edge to New Orleans. So I think regardless of what the score is, we're going to see a tight matchup between these two teams.
See, I don't know. I think the Saints could actually pull away in this game. The team they've been in, it's similar to the Patriots, it's similar to the Chiefs, too. The Rams are really the only team left that travels well. Not that it matters for the Saints and the Chiefs at this point, but the Saints are such a better team at home. And yeah, people are going to bring up the Dallas game where they struggled and the Carolina game where they struggled. And that was on the road. This team in that dome has been a wagon. They have been the bee's knees, as good as they can get. Drew Brees is turning back the clock. If the game's in LA, I think it's a different story, but I think in both of the games this weekend, and we'll get to it in a little bit with the Patriots, but I think in both of the games this weekend, home field advantage is a much bigger factor than people realize.
I definitely agree with that. I think the fact that you have a veteran quarterback, a guy who's, 39, 40 years old, and Drew Brees in his home venue, in a dome, controlled environment, this is the type of game that he should go off in. On the other side, you have Jared Goff, who's a young quarterback, hasn't really proven a whole lot in the playoffs, that is. And this is really going to be a huge test for him. Will he answer the call? Will he actually perform and carry his team? They have the roster. They have the talent. You said it. Both teams have a ton of firepower. But I do give the edge to the Saints as well. I think we'll see a decent one. I do think it's going to be closer than you're giving your credit for. But
I think it will. Okay, if one of the two games is going to be a blowout, I think it's that one.
Okay, I might agree with that, but I think that's more because of the environment that the other game's going to be in rather than the matchup.
Okay, that's fair.
So I don't know. I just look at the Saints and how they kind of struggled towards the end of the year. The one positive with them is they did find a way to win in most of those games. There were a few. Right. You talk about the Panthers, and then obviously Week 17, that was a wash since they already locked up the one seed. But this is a team that, although their offense wasn't as potent, they found ways to win. And when you're in the postseason, that's what really matters. Who's going to make the plays when it matters? And, I mean, I'm going Drew Brees in that instance. So for this one, I do have the Saints. They're at home, top seed in the league, and they've been relatively consistent in regard to just winning throughout the year.
I do like what you said there in the key plays, because if the Rams are going to have a shot in this game, there's two guys I'm really going to be looking at that have to go off for the Rams to win, one on each side of the ball. I think Brandon Cooks, his playoff performance from last year, granted he's in a new city, but I think his playoff performance from last year, specifically trying to hurdle the guy in the Super Bowl, that's still hanging over him. He needs to be elite in this game for the Rams to match the Saints score for score. And then on the other side, Aaron Donald. The best chance that the Rams have in this game is for Aaron Donald to be in Drew Brees' face the entire time. If Donald can't get that push, can't get in the pocket, can't get Drew Brees off his spot, Brees is going to pick the Rams defense apart. It's up to the Rams pass rush to make things tricky, specifically Darnold. Wow. Did I say, I think I said that before too, right? Donald.
Donald. Yes.
Donald, not Darnold. Darnold well out of the playoffs. We don't have to worry about it. All right. I was on with Jake Asman last night. He was trying to get me to admit that Sam Darnold was going to take over the AFC East in the next couple of years. And I won't try as he might. I won't do it. All right. Patriots Chiefs. I don't even know where to start with this one. I do know where to start, actually. I want to start in Miami. This game should be in New England. There's supposed to be 6 inches to a foot of snow this weekend. This team nails it home. I would get to be going if the game was in New England. This is something that I that play, the only thing I can think that compares to it, if you remember back to 4th-and-2 against Indy, and that play was talked about at the end. You just knew at that point, okay, this team can't win a Super Bowl. You knew from a play in the middle of the season, this team can't win a Super Bowl. And in Miami, if things go wrong, Kansas City, for the Patriots, you're going to look back to that play in Miami and say, was the team doomed from that moment? Having to go on the road, is that what ultimately did this team in?
If it's a close game and they lose in a late drive or in the fourth quarter, I mean, you're pointing to that play. You're pointing to that specific game. And I mean, more notably, you're pointing to just the lack of winning on the road in general during the regular season. That said, if they win, obviously people are going to remember it, obviously, but it's not going to be that significant in regard to
it. Doesn't hang over. It doesn't become the defining moment of the 2018 Patriots.
Exactly. I'm more confident than I was leaving that game, of course, and even leaving the regular season. They're coming off of their best game of the season.
It was still at home. They haven't played a road game in over a month, and I think that's misleading.
It was at home, but they were energized, and I think that's the bigger thing. That's the more important thing. The fact that they actually woke up, they're taking this us versus them mentality, and I think they're kind of rallying behind that. This is somewhat similar to the whole Deflategate debacle when they came back and they ended up beating the Seahawks, and then they ended up beating the Falcons. It's that underdog mentality that's really worked in their favor, and I think it's caused them to play at another level. It was a home game, but it's momentum. It is still momentum, and at the end of the day, you're going up against a young quarterback, a pretty young team, and a coach that is brutal towards the end of the game. So for me, this is a game that will be close. And if you're playing a close game against Andy Reid, I'll tell you who's going to win. It's going to be the team that Andy Reid is not coaching, in my opinion, especially when the other guy is Bill Belichick.
I do want to go into the underdog thing, but real quick on Andy Reid, and this can get skewed a couple different ways, but Andy Reid's outcoached Bill Belichick recently. Even though the Patriots won the regular season matchup this year, you go back to the opener 2 years ago, you look at that second half the Chiefs had this year, you're right, it needs to be close, because I'm convinced that early on Andy Reid and Bill Belichick are going to go toe-to-toe. And the Patriots need to come out with the game plan equivalent, not the same game plan, it's a different team, different week, different circumstances, but the game plan equivalent of what they had last week, because I thought, you know, from the top down, Belichick, McDaniels, Flores, everybody, I thought they had the perfect game plan against LA, I almost said San Diego, against the Chargers. But the underdog thing, If you saw the head story on ESPN.com today, I mean, it sums up what is a pretty common narrative right now that, guess what? People are pissed that the Patriots are calling themselves the underdog. People don't like this. Well, how can you have Tom Brady and be the underdog? He's the greatest of all time. And you mentioned Deflategate. These are the same people that since Deflategate, since the massacre, the Monday night massacre in Kansas City, the 41-14 loss, all of it, have been telling us that Tom Brady's on the doorstep. The Max Kellermans, the Seth Wickershams, these people. Now, they are trying to claim it the other way. They are trying to cover their tracks. Now that Tom Brady is the underdog, oh, you can't. You can't call Tom Brady the underdog. What a pompous assertion for him to say that. He's the greatest of all time. When they were saying before, yeah, he's the greatest of all time, but he's not good anymore. They can't pick the narrative. And I think what people are missing is this. Tom Brady is not the underdog quarterback in this matchup. Patrick Mahomes is probably going to win the MVP. He had the better season statistically. Absolutely. But he's never played in a game of this magnitude. He's never played a team like he is going to play. He has never played a coach like he is going to play. And before you tell me, oh, they played in the regular season, you tell me, you look me in the eye and tell me the October Patriots are the same team as the January Patriots. And that October Bill Belichick is the same as January Bill Belichick, because that's not true. Okay? This is going to be the toughest task Patrick Mahomes has ever faced.
Absolutely.
He is the underdog quarterback in this game. Mahomes is. But as it always is in New England, win or lose, good or bad, +3 or -3 in Vegas, the underdog moniker, and I want everybody to listen. I want everybody in Bristol to listen. I want everybody in New York, Buffalo, and Miami to listen, because it is important they understand this, because this is what has been the difference between the Patriots for the last 19 years and every other team in the NFL. Tom Brady is not the underdog this week. The New England Patriots are. This is the Kansas City Chiefs game to lose. They have more talent. They are at home in favorable conditions. This is the Kansas City Chiefs game to lose. It was the St. Louis Rams game to lose in 2001. It was Peyton's game to lose multiple times early on in that decade. Okay? It was the Seahawks game to lose in 2014. The Patriots, going into a lot of these big matchups, have never been the more talented team. But they get this underdog mentality under their skin. They open up to the outside world. It's the only time they ever do it. And they understand what it takes to win when you are the underdog. So for everybody, the ESPN piece today, I'm sorry I'm going on, Lebowitz, I'm almost done.
Keep going.
ESPN piece today was essentially the same kind of hit piece that was coming out for the last 2 years, from Deflategate to the Butler benching to all of it. But it just read in a sarcastic tone. Same words, sarcastic tone. It went from Tom Brady's not good anymore, he's in his 40s, to Tom Brady's not good anymore, he's in his 40s, okay? The Patriots are the underdog, not Tom Brady. Hate that. We can never win, and that's why it's fun, because they're always right and we're always wrong. The Patriots are the underdog, not Tom Brady.
Well, it's the anti-Patriot rhetoric. It's whatever, however you can get on it. It's like, I don't know. I think Brady's going to fall off a cliff. I don't know. Brady comes out. They didn't believe in us all season long. What? You're Tom Brady. How can you say that? You're married to Giselle. Like, shut up. It is ridiculous how the entire country, media, I'm speaking about, and fans all looked at this team. And yes, I think you and I are kind of included. We didn't think they would make a run in this postseason. So my point isn't that, oh, you're wrong in your face. My point is we all looked at them as the underdog, because during the regular season, they stunk on the road and they weren't winning games that they should have. And we can go back to that Miami game again. That's Exhibit A. So yeah, they're going to use that as a chip on their shoulder because they believe in themselves, as most NFL teams should. It's just, it's a way you win games. It's a way you rally the troops. And it worked for them on last Sunday. So I do think it is ridiculous how there is this kind of this back and forth, this inconsistency in these takes from these high-level media personalities, to act like calling Tom Brady saying the Patriots were the underdog is this blasphemous thing. They were this season. I think a lot of people thought the Chargers were going to come in there and whoop them. They didn't. They got smacked around. Now, this Sunday, I think people are a little bit more hesitant, and I think most people look at this game as a toss-up, which is probably the right way to look at it. Now, when looking at this game and looking at whether Patrick Mahomes is going to perform in his biggest game, in the biggest game of his career, I think it will all come down to that first quarter. I think we're going to see Bill Belichick and the New England Patriots, Brian Flores, throw something at him that he has not seen before, just like what they did on Sunday against Phillip Rivers. If Patrick Mahomes responds to that right early on, the Patriots are screwed. That's my opinion. I think we'll see everything we need to know within those first few drives. If what they're throwing at him isn't messing with his head, isn't getting into that young guy's head, and he isn't making mistakes, he's throwing the ball like he has been all season long, he's making good decisions, he's playing like an MVP caliber quarterback, they're not winning that game. That said, the defense looked really good last week. The offensive line looked really good last week. Most importantly, Tom Brady looked really good last week. So maybe they're not underdogs going into this one necessarily. They might technically be underdogs, but again, people are looking at it as a toss-up. But last week, that was a statement win because they had something to prove. And I think they did just that.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree with you on your analysis of the game this week. I think what matters is how they start. A lot of these bad road performances, I mean, you look at Pittsburgh, how flat the offense came out to start that game. You look at Miami, how flat the defense was at times, not just on that last play, at times. They got to have the energy. They got to come out. They got to get out to a hot start. But I haven't booked my ticket to Atlanta yet. I'll say that. I haven't booked my ticket to Atlanta yet. This is I have a piece coming out on CLNS Media on .com on Friday. Basically, I came up with a mathematical formula to rank the difficulty of matchups for an opponent in the playoffs. I have the Chiefs in this 8-year run. The Chiefs are the second toughest opponent the Patriots have faced behind that 2013 Broncos team with Peyton Manning that set all the records offensively. It's a very similar team. It's a very similar situation surrounding the game. And we all remember how that went in 2013.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyway, we have a lot more to talk about besides football, believe it or not. The Celtics, I think some of the things that we've been speculating on the show, Lebowitz, they're starting to bubble through to the surface. So we, of course, have to talk about that. Keep it here. This is Callin' It, powered by CLNS.
Callin' It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Welcome back to Callin' It. Alex Barth and Alex Lebowitz with you. I didn't give the date off the top. Thursday, January 17th is when we are recording this, just before dinner time. A little less than 24 hours ago, the Celtics played a game that they had to show up for against the Toronto Raptors. They won. Kyrie hit an awesome three at the end. It was very cool. Of course, you know, when this team's in doubt, they beat a team like the Raptors at home. It'll be fun until they lose to the Hawks in Atlanta next week. But I don't so much want to talk about the game as much as what's been going on with the team off the floor, because it's been a mess. And you can look at it as the old guys versus the young guys. I've been kind of looking at it as the guys who played in the playoffs last year versus the guys who didn't. But there clearly is a difference, and I said this last week, and I feel like every, you know, not to toot my own horn, every week I say something about the Celtics, and then a week later I'm coming on saying I said this last week and I was vindicated. The Celtics, just the mentality of the individuals on that team was much better suited for being the underdogs with a chip on their shoulder with a common enemy than being the front runners.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, personally, I haven't seen a team take a 180 like the Celtics have in regard to likability. Yep. It really is amazing.
Chemistry,
everything. And so, I mean, they have a lot of personalities, and I think that.
No way. I'll give you one though. The other way, the Red Sox did it the other way.
They did. And 2013.
That's the only thing I can, well, no, I'm talking last year to this year. Remember how much we hated the 2017 Red Sox. And that's they come back and win them. So you want to talk about likability. Well, I mean, they did the opposite.
And they did it twice. I mean, if we count a 2-year stretch, I'll go 2011.
True. That's 2013. Fair, yeah.
It was 2 years, but still, that 2011 team was the least liked Red Sox team in my lifetime. 2013, probably the most liked Red Sox team of
my Celtics. Yeah. Sorry.
But with the Celtics, yeah, this is the biggest 180 in the bad direction that yeah. I've seen the team take in regards to, yeah, chemistry, likability, everything. And you know what? That's because they do have a lot of strong personalities. They have talent. They have strong personalities. And those strong personalities responded to adversity when they were looked at as the underdogs. Now that they've been hyped up, they bought into it. And those strong personalities essentially turned into egos. So we're getting a lot of that infighting, as it's been called. And guys like Kyrie Irving, who need to step up as a leader, have not been doing so effectively at all. And I don't think the younger guys have been responding to it very well. But my thing is, where does Brad Stevens play into all this? Is this his biggest detriment as a head coach? Is this a place where he is the worst, that he's the worst at? Can he not manage personalities in a locker room? Right now, he's not doing all that well. And I just don't know how it's going to turn around. I don't have a lot of confidence in this team, even though they did beat the Raptors yesterday. But something has to change. I'm not saying it's a trade, but there's been a drastic turnaround in this team in the negative, and it's worrisome to watch.
So I'm going to tag in right here because Brad Stevens is not getting enough attention in all of this. And I've said this before, but just quickly to reiterate, this is the oldest team Brad Stevens has ever coached between college and his first couple years in the NBA. It's the most experienced team he's ever coached. It's the first team he's ever coached where there's no intrinsic motivation, right? In college, you're playing to get a spot in the NBA. You're playing for your scholarship, March Madness, et cetera. And then at this point, early on, the early teams he coached, guys were very young. They were certainly – you didn't have the top picks like Jaylen Brown. They were guys who were trying to prove themselves as NBA players. Now you have a team that was just 10 minutes away from the NBA Finals and clearly thinks it's easy to go back. I think part of the problem with the Celtics is – and I think – correct me if I'm wrong on this because I've had some people get mad at me for this take and jump in when I say something incorrect. But it's safe to say the Celtics had a common enemy last year, the last 2 years – in the Cleveland Cavaliers and LeBron James, right? Everybody's saying that they're not as good as the Cavs. They have no chance to get to the finals, et cetera. And that was all probably true. But am I off base, Lebowitz, in saying that I think some of that, like we just talked about with the Patriots, some of that narrative helped the team, especially when they lost guys like Kyrie Irving?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair. It's that underdog mentality. Right. They were not the top seed in the East. Coming into this year, they were the favorites to come out. They're the favorites right. to come out of the Eastern Conference. Now, I mean, but that's a huge issue. Like, if it takes for them to struggle for 3 months to bounce back and, you know, win everyone's trust back, that's just not sustainable. And that's a huge problem.
So let me keep going then. I think what the Celtics need at this point, and you mentioned the failing of Brad Stevens as a motivator as opposed to as a team builder or as a tactical genius, is Brad needs to go into that locker room, throw a chair, knock a water cooler over, start yelling. Just look, I'm supposed to be the next great coach in the NBA. You're all making me look bad. He needs to go in there and pitch a fit because Kyrie's not doing it. Now Horford's not doing it. And Jaylen Brown and Terry Rozier are not the people who should be doing it. And Danny Ainge needs to make a trade. Danny Ainge needs to let them know that he doesn't think they're good enough as constituted right now. Jaylen Brown, Terry Rozier, those two guys should be off this team come the trade deadline. I'll say it. They should be. I know Jaylen has future potential, whatever. He's not going to be a superstar. He's not going to be Jason Tatum. A guy with – Kyrie is the superstar on this team. Bill Simmons, say what you will about Bill Simmons. He had a theory earlier this week on Twitter that I actually kind of believe. In every NBA locker room, there can only be one alpha because the rosters are so small and it's such an individual-driven sport. It's not like football where you get four captains. There can only be one alpha. And if it's not the best player on the team, you run into problems. Kyrie Irving needs to be the alpha on this team. It cannot be Jaylen Brown. It cannot be Terry Rozier. The only two people maybe who could get away with it are Al Horford because he was the original Max guy and Marcus Smart because he's been here the longest and he actually tries every single night.
What about Marcus Morris?
Marcus Morris is on a one-year deal. You don't want him establishing himself as the leader because when he goes and chases the money this offseason, there's a void.
That's true.
So Brad Stevens, Danny Ainge, they need to become the common enemy for this team. The theme in the locker room needs to be, hey, Brad doesn't think we're good enough. Danny doesn't think we're good enough. Let's prove them wrong. Because without LeBron in the East to chase, and look, I know Giannis is probably as much of a threat. He's not the same enemy that LeBron is. Nobody is saying that the Bucks are going to be gifted the Eastern Conference spot in the finals. Kawhi is a very good player. Nobody is saying the Raptors are going to be gifted the Eastern Conference spot in the finals. The Celtics were gifted it back in August. They need a common enemy to get that fire back. And at this point, it could be one of two people. And it, frankly, should be both. Brad Stevens and Danny Ainge. Don't think Danny Ainge doesn't know this. Danny Ainge went through this with Red Auerbach. He should have been picking up on this. And the best way he can do it is to trade one of, preferably both, Jaylen Brown and Terry Rozier.
Here's the issue that I see. I think personally that this season is kind of a wash. Will they make it in deep into the playoffs? They could. They could absolutely make it deep into the playoffs. But I don't think they're a realistic championship contender. And I also think that Danny Ainge has his sights set on a guy like Anthony Davis or a big piece. That's been the name that's floated around.
But we've gone down this road. They had their eyes on Paul George, and it was, it's not about this year. It's about the future. They're young. And then they had their eyes on Kawhi, and, it's not about right now. It's about the future. They're young.
Here's the issue, and I don't know. I'm not an NBA contracts guru, and I think someone who knows more about it could explain it better. But the way that Anthony Davis's contract is set up, you'd have to wait until the offseason to make a deal for Anthony Davis. And
I believe that is true. Unless you trade Kyrie Irving, that is true.
Exactly. So I think two pieces that are going to have to be in that deal that makes sense for not only the Pelicans, but also the Celtics are, you mentioned it, Jaylen Brown and Terry Rozier. If you want to make that deal that will sustain, you know, a winning team for at least 3, 4, 5 years, you can't trade Brown or Rozier. And you're going to have to put up with this chemistry instability for the remainder of the season. And that's unfortunate. It stinks, but it's worth doing if you can get a guy like Anthony Davis.
If it means Kyrie leaves, what if Kyrie's just like, I can't take it with Jaylen Brown? And even if they say, we're going to trade him, he bails for New York.
Kyrie Irving wants to be a LeBron James type. He wants to be treated like that. Danny Ainge, bring him in. You want to extend him? Extend him. Let him know what the plan is.
They want to extend him. He won't sign it. That seems to be the indication, is that he's waiting to see what happens with this team. And I think the longer Jaylen Brown and Terry Rozier are here, and the more there's these problems in the locker room, look, are you encouraged by the fact that he called LeBron James and talked to him and tried to make up with him?
That was brutal. That was a
really
dumb
sounds like
move.
Somebody who has his eyes on a reunion. That sounds like somebody who's looking at L.A.
I don't think it's someone who has an eye on a reunion. I think it's someone who is being the bad type of leader. I think I
don't know. That worried me. And look, with the Anthony Davis thing, nobody wants Anthony Davis on the Celtics more than me. I've been saying it for a year. Since they missed out on DeMarcus Cousins, which was still a missed opportunity. The first time, not in free agency, when they traded Buddy freaking Hield for him, which is a rant I'm not going to go on right now. But –
They've had
how many top draft picks? 3 max contract players. How many gems deep in the draft, like Robert Williams? What more does this team need? What more realistically does this team need? Roster construction-wise, they probably are the best team in the NBA. From a roster construction point of view, even with LeBron, I don't know that the Lakers are better. I don't know that the Raptors are better. The Bucks maybe. But what more exactly does this team need? It shouldn't take a top 3 player in the league at this point. The problems are internal. Anthony Davis isn't fixing this. The problems are coming from inside the locker room level.
It's not the addition of Anthony Davis that fixes it. Of course, he'll be an addition. I mean, talent-wise, that's as big of an addition as you can get. It's about the subtraction. Getting rid of a couple guys who haven't been meshing.
Do it already.
But then you're removing two key players, two of your top seven players on your roster.
They can afford it.
Who are they going to get in return?
You're going to get somebody. I don't know. Go get a shooter and go get a backup point guard, or go get a big man and get a draft pick. I don't care. It's addition by subtraction. I am sick of hearing the excuse. You remember me yelling about this last year when we were saying it didn't matter when people were saying it didn't matter what they did against the Cavs in the Eastern Conference Finals. I am sick of Celtics fans making the excuse of it's not about this year. This team has a long future. It's all going to happen in the future. It's the future. There's no Nets picks left. But this is it. This is the team. Go out and win. Try to win a title. Stop pushing it off.
But here's the problem.
I'm angry today. No, I
understand it. You're my spirit animal right now. Here's the problem. Here's the problem. Yeah. You can't keep everyone you have right now. So the future is going to be different. Like, that's inevitable. You're going to have to remove some of these pieces. So you just cannot stay set. I understand the argument that you have the roster as is and it's good enough to compete for a championship. I get that. And I'd agree. But at some point, you're going to have to part ways with a Jaylen Brown or a Terry.
That's what I'm saying. Why are you waiting? Why not do it when you know it will help the team right now? Why do it now?
Why not get something that can make you even better instead of just trying to
– Maybe they can.
Not during the regular season.
It's such a mess with the trade machine on ESPN and all the salary cap stuff. But you go out and you get not – okay, let me be clear. Not Kyle Korver because he is ancient. But go out and get a guy like that, a veteran, a perimeter shooter who will work in Brad's system, who has been there before and won. Those guys are always getting moved at the deadline. Guys, late 20s, early 30s, decent shooter, can come off the bench, give you 20 minutes a night, right? That kind of Eddie House guy. They're always – I don't have any specific names off the top of my head because I don't know how the contracts work and all of that.
Yeah.
But those guys get moved a dime a dozen at the deadline.
So are you
get that 7'2" moose game-controlling rebounder that this team hasn't had in years, that Tyson Chandler, again, not him, too old, the contract doesn't work, but that kind of guy that are a dime a dozen in the NBA – and then maybe pick up a draft pick because you're giving up a better player than you're getting. That you don't think that helps this team right now?
I think it might. So are you hell bent on getting rid of both of them, or would you be up for getting rid of one of them?
At least one.
Okay, and I'd be more willing for that because I don't want them to give up two.
Jaylen, because I think he is. Jaylen Brown has never not until he got to the NBA had never not been the best player on his team. And then he got to experience at least a little bit of that last year during the playoffs. Rozier's the same way, but I think, you know, you don't have a backup point guard. You have multiple guys who can play Jaylen Brown's role. Jaylen Brown is not handling being a role player well. And that is, I think, where a lot of these problems are coming from. He does not like not being the center of attention. Send him somewhere he can be and just be done with it. Because as long as Jason Tatum's here, and Jason Tatum better have a Tom Brady, David Ortiz-esque career in Boston – 15, 20 years in the same uniform. As long as Jason Tatum is here, Jaylen Brown will never get the attention that he wants. Don't bother trying to please him because that's all he's good. That's all that's going to fix it for him. And there is no reason the Celtics should give him that.
Listen, it's clear. It's clear that Jaylen Brown is going to be done at the very least once his contract expires. And they're probably going to trade him away. But I don't want to
That's this year. It's up at the end of the year. This is 4 years.
Yeah. Okay.
If you don't trade him now. That's it.
Well, I would. What the thought was is it would be a sign and trade at the end of the year
okay,
to send over to the Pelicans. So he is going to be gone. Like once this season does end, he's done. He's done with the Celtics. That seems evident. Seems like he is on his way out. It's just a question of one, if you think this season is salvageable, and two,
I believe it is. We do have Kyrie Irving and Al Horford and Jason Tatum. It should be.
It should be. Yeah, theoretically, it should be. Guess what? I have maybe 15% confidence in this team right now. And that would have been zero had they lost yesterday.
Look at what the Cavs did last year. They didn't win the whole thing. They got to the Eastern Conference Finals. They turn over 7-8 players on the roster at the deadline? I'm not saying the Celtics need to do that.
They also don't have LeBron James.
But they have that Cavs team had LeBron James and nobody else. Celtics have Kyrie Irving, Al Horford, Jason Tate. That's your big three. Forget Gordon Hayward. That's your big three. Those three guys give you as much, if not more, of a shot than LeBron James if you can put the right pieces around them.
We'll see. I don't know. They have, it's, again, January 17th. They've been...
Great deadline's coming up. Was it February 4th, February 7th, something like that?
I'm not sure the exact date, but hey, maybe a move happens.
February 7th.
I do think Danny Ainge is eyeing that offseason move, though. I think he's eyeing that offseason trade.
He's always done that. Danny Ainge never acts quick enough. I've had this complaint about him a lot, and he's made some great moves. I don't think he's a bad GM, but I think sometimes he expects things to be done on his schedule, and it's not always going to work like that.
And
things aren't going to work out exactly how he plans them.
And that's – you know what? And it's a weird conundrum because that's the detriment of being such a great trader. When you make that move with the Nets and you fleece a lot of teams, you get Isaiah Thomas for practically nothing. There's going to be teams that are hesitant and be like, what do they see in this guy? Why? But I think Anthony Davis, obviously everyone sees a lot in him. So that's a move that, that would be more feasible because it's, you know, it is what it is. We'll see. We'll see. I'm not going to hold my breath. I don't know if he's going to pull the trigger on a deal. It's clear that there's dysfunction, but we're not in that locker room. I don't know. Maybe something can happen. But after Kyrie's comments yesterday, and after the way he's been handling this, and Jaylen Brown and company and Brad Stevens, I'm not too confident. I'm not too confident. That said, we'll have to wait and see what they do. And if Anthony Davis is on the table in the offseason, guess what? I want to wait. I want to hold out.
Yeah, we talked about it last week. There's a lot of games coming up, albeit they're all at home, that, that are going to tell us a lot. So the story of this team, I think we both agree, for one reason or another, is far from written. On the other side, a lot of Hollywood happenings today, this past week. Our Twitter bio does say Sports and Entertainment Podcast. We're going to tickle the entertainment part of it. This is Calling It, powered by CLNS.
Calling It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Welcome back to Calling It with Alex Barth and Alex Lovitz. We're powered by CLNS. We're at like 40 minutes already on two segments. So third segment normally runs long. We'll see what we can do here on this. But it is a rare trip down the entertainment hole for us. Do you consider yourself a big like pop culture guy? I don't. I haven't for a couple of years.
I mean, it depends on what we're talking. We're talking about like movies and like TV, sure. Music, like
current pop culture.
What was that?
Like current pop culture. Like, will you know the names at like the Oscars and the Emmys and the?
No, I don't. You know, I don't care about the. I like the Oscars. I don't like the Oscars. I like the movies that the Oscars awards
ignores or awards.
Both. I like most movies.
Okay. Well, I'm saying like I hear about celebrities that I just have no idea who they are anymore. So we're going to throw it back a little bit to do entertainment. Tell me if this is far back enough for you. Betty White. Happy 97th birthday to Betty White. James Earl Jones' birthday today too as well. And I'll tell you,
he's got to be close to 92.
I'm going to check. I should probably have looked this up before we started. So happy birthday to Darth Vader himself, James Earl Jones. 88.
88.
Old 1931. But you know, you wake up in the morning, you check Twitter, you see Betty White's trending, you see James Earl Jones is trending. It was a tough couple seconds there before I saw why, you know.
Yeah, I mean the rational thought is 97, 88, big figures trending, dead question mark. Fortunately,
right. Yeah,
not.
That's what you're see. I'll say this though, is there anybody like on movies or TV right now more unintentionally hilarious than Betty White? And what I mean is like Betty White's not a comedian, but she, anytime you put her in a comedy situation, she just kills it.
She is anyone who's, I don't know. That's a tough question.
I don't think it's just an age thing. Like I'd throw Christopher Walken in there. I'd throw Liam Neeson in there. Those were the first two that came to mind besides Betty White for me.
Christopher Walken is flat out funny. And the thing with Christopher Walken is he's just a character. He has a specific way of speaking. He has a weird look.
He's like he's a serious, dramatic, intense actor is what I mean.
But I don't know if I classify him as that. Although obviously he's been in some unbelievable movies.
Right.
But I don't know. I would lean Nielsen.
What's the first thing you think of when you think of Christopher Walken in terms of like role?
First role I think of. Whew. I love
he's
so many.
He's got the cowbell sketch in SNL.
That's one of them. He's great in Joe Dirt. He's great in. He's Click.
Right. But the first thing I think, Click was a horrible movie. What? Do not get me started. Click was the worst Adam Sandler movie.
You obviously haven't seen Jack and Jill.
Okay. Well, like, you know, like during, it was a role of like great Adam Sandler movies and that was in the middle of it. And it was just Click's. I went to Click, think, all right, it's going to be a fun movie. Adam Sandler controls time. It'll laugh. The first half of the movie, like I laughed, it lived up to it. The second half's just like depressingly sad.
Okay,
it's
that's
a brutal movie to sit through, and I went in just not expecting that.
Off topic here real quick, but Funny People is one of my favorite Adam Sandler movies.
And that is a good movie.
It's an amazing movie, but it is super depressing.
But that one, like, you knew going in that, okay, this is going to – you didn't think the trailers, none of it, you thought Click was going to have any really sad parts. The whole second half of the movie was tearjerker.
But that's great. It brought you –
No, it's not. I went to laugh.
I know, but that was objectively speaking, that was a good Adam Sandler. I think that was one of the last good Adam Sandler movies.
Think it was one of the first bad ones.
It was like 50 First Dates, Click, and then it kind of started going downhill. There he had Chuck and Larry, which is good, and then Just Go With It. Or no, not Just Go With It. That's My Boy.
Chuck and Larry was funny.
That was a good one.
That was a good movie.
So, but yeah, Christopher Walken and Click, he was great. He's great in anything he does. Catch Me If You Can. He was great in Pulp Fiction, that little role he had there. So I think he's just funny. I wouldn't classify him as a dramatic actor who's funny. He's just a funny actor in general. But there are a lot of people who it's tough. I'd have to think about that one who are just usually, Steve Buscemi's great.
Oh, Buscemi's another one. He can be really funny when he needs to be.
Underrated
in The Sopranos, I think, by the way, Steve Buscemi. Underrated in The Sopranos.
You know, I haven't seen The Sopranos.
You got to watch it. It's really good.
I know. I'm
a little late to the party. I just watched it this summer for the first time.
I started it, and with most things, I didn't keep up. And I got to get back in.
It's so great. I couldn't turn away from it. The first minute.
Yeah. No, it was really good. It was very good. And Karen was in it from Goodfellas.
There's a lot. I think it's 27 actors appear in both Goodfellas and The Sopranos.
Really? Edie
there's
Falco.
There's a lot in common. Edie Falco. Some of them are like they have a small background role in one of them, but there's 20. I think the number's 27 actors in common. The kid who plays Chris in The Sopranos is Spider in Goodfellas. That was my favorite. The kid that Joe Pesci kills.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Spider.
But anyway, we wanted to talk some TV
that actually gave me an answer. Robert De Niro.
Ooh.
And Joe Pesci.
Good call, Alex Leibowitz.
And Joe Pesci. They're duo.
True. Robert De Niro's been killing it on SNL.
He's good on SNL. I haven't seen him on SNL, but he's great
Mueller. He's been Robert Mueller.
Oh, has he? I don't watch any of that stuff. He's good in Meet the Parents, Meet the Fockers. Yeah. Hilarious in those movies. But even movies in which they aren't supposed to be funny, like Joe Pesci in Goodfellas is hilarious. Oh. He's straight up hilarious.
What do you mean I'm funny? How am I funny?
Funny how? Like a clown? Casino? Oh my God!
Saying that he's not supposed to be funny—it's the funniest part of that movie.
Yeah, it's amazing. It really is.
Like a clown funny.
He kills the guy. He kills the guy who told him get your shine box,
goes to his mother's to get the knife.
Oh, it's the what do they call the hoof.
Yeah, I gotta get the hoof, the paw. I gotta get it out of.
But when he's in the bar and he's cleaned up and he looks up at Henry Hill, played by Ray Liotta, of course. And he just murdered a guy and he looks at him and goes, I'm sorry, I got blood on the floor. he's like really apologetic that I got blood on the floor, but no remorse that he just murdered a man. But oh my God, Joe Pesci, Rob De Niro. I think that answers it. Those two guys. Home Alone. Yeah. Joe Pesci's great in Home Alone too.
Yeah.
Jack Nicholson.
Jack. We could keep going. Basically, anybody who plays a mobster or a gang member, and plus Betty White, I would love to see Betty White as like a mob member. Maybe the one role she hasn't played yet.
That'd be great. Yeah, mobster granny.
Yeah. All right. The one other thing we wanted to touch on, Hollywood-wise, Leibowitz, you were all excited about this. I'm cautiously optimistic. Steve Carell, Greg Daniels, the brains behind The Office, they're getting back together. They are going to do I think it's going to be a sitcom, right?
Netflix sitcom, I believe.
It's going to be on Netflix about the Donald Trump's Space Force, which, I mean, I do see some potential, but what's holding me back is Greg Daniels did try a second time after The Office with Parks and Rec, which was a good show, but it didn't live up to the hype. And there was never any crossover. I think there should have been a crossover episode, but at the very least, maybe you bring an ancillary character from Scranton and have them show up in Pawnee, right? Like with Cheers and Frasier and Wings, there would be characters that like randomly showed up. Like it just tell me it's in the same universe. Let me know it's in the same universe. That's all I ask. So I think he tried too hard to make his follow-up projects not enough like The Office that he missed the boat. I hope he draws from The Office in Space Force.
Draw from The Office, sir. I don't want a crossover, though. I don't think the crossover is going to work.
But I'm just saying there should have been one with Parks and Rec in The Office. That was
you know what was a great crossover? A good crossover?
Like guy with Simpsons?
It was I wasn't a huge fan of that one. But I liked when Ricky Gervais is in The Office.
Oh, yeah, I'm trying to remember. I remember that happening. I don't remember at all what happened.
David Brent, they're at the elevator.
Right. That was like towards the end, though. That was when they were really grasping for straws, wasn't it?
No, that was towards the end of when Steve Carell was on the show. So that was like season 7, I want to say. And it was Carell had maybe a couple episodes left. But here's the difference between Parks and Rec and The Office. There was no Steve Carell in Parks and Rec. Steve Carell was The Office.
I think Amy Poehler is Steve Carell-esque.
No one's Steve Carell. Amy
Poehler is very good in that show.
No, she is. And they, you know what? Both shows had unbelievable cast.
Yes.
And I'm not taking away from, like, I mean, what's his name? Nick Offerman.
Nick Offerman, Rob Lowe, Rashida Jones, Aziz Ansari. The kid who plays, he's a very minor character in Parks and Rec. My biggest gripe with Parks and Rec, actually. Not Adam Scott. I forget his name. He plays Jean Ralphio.
Oh, Ben Schwartz.
Annoying kid who's like, yeah, my grandfather just died, but I am flush with cat. I can't do it.
She's the word. Yeah, no, right. I know the guy.
Like that character should have had a spinoff. That's what I'm talking about. Like, have that character go show up, and I don't think it would have worked because I think The Office was done at this point, but have that character show up in Scranton.
The guy who played him, Ben Schwartz, used to do interviews for ESPN back when he worked. I think he was with College Humor. And they were really funny interviews. He didn't interview like Sean Marion. He interviewed Nastia Lukin, and it was just him be like, "Hey, so will you go out with me?" And it was just really awkward, but very funny. One other crossover, not a crossover, but a guest appearance. And this goes back to The Office. I'm a massive Office fan. I think it's the greatest sitcom ever. Two people. Will Ferrell
was great.
I loved him in The Office. Same with oh my God, Kate. What's her name? She was the head of Saber.
Not Kathy. Kathy Bates. I will say, I remember when I found out when I was, I think middle school, maybe freshman year high school, when I found out Steve Carell was leaving, I remember saying to somebody, the only two people who could properly who could replace Steve Carell and I'd still care. It was Will Ferrell. And I forget who the other one was. I think it was Chris Rock. But I was so excited. I was right, Will Ferrell. And then he was gone in like 3 episodes.
Yeah. And the way he went out was really funny. And that was good. I'm more of a cameo guy in these types of shows.
I mean, cameos in any show are great. I mean, that's part of the reason The Simpsons is as legendary as it is because they get everybody.
Yeah. I mean, and that's like, it's kind of like the Wikipedia of cartoons. Like if you get onto The Simpsons as a guest voice or character, you've made it. You've made it.
Well, do you know how South Park does theirs? I found this out recently.
Does what?
Their cameos.
How's that?
They're against celebrities voicing themselves. I think Elon Musk was the first one. I think he was the first one to do it. But like when the show was first getting popular, Jerry Seinfeld wanted to do one. Jay Leno wanted to do one. So they said, okay. So do you remember the episode Big Gay Al's Big Gay Boat Ride?
Yes.
So in that episode, Jerry Seinfeld voices a pig. He says oink once. Jay Leno voices a turkey, and again, he makes one turkey noise, and that's his whole appearance.
You know who's?
That's how they put celebrities in their show.
There was one more who is in South Park, and I'm not sure if this was before or after Friends, but Jennifer Aniston was in the Rainforest episode.
In which episode?
The Rainforest episode.
Oh, really?
There's a song "Getting Gay with Kids" It's like it's pretty offensive, but that's South Park for you. And right. She was the counselor, and she really hated Cartman, but she was like a well-intentioned counselor.
I gotta go back and watch that episode.
Bill Hader also does voices. He did Jimmy Vollmer's father.
Well, he was a voice actor. That's different. He wasn't a big deal when he was doing that.
No, he was on SNL. He was a big deal for sure. But he also wrote for them, which is another.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. And they don't do that. They don't bring a lot of people into that writer's room. But he was Jimmy's dad. And pretty much every voice, it's like a handful of people, most of which are Trey Parker, Matt Stone. That's, you want to talk about greatest shows of all time. That's it.
You know who's gotten great with that is BoJack Horseman. There's a lot. They pull a lot for voices. Like, they have a great cast doing voices for BoJack Horseman. Aaron Paul's their throwaway character, right? Keith Olbermann has great, and I'm not a huge Keith Olbermann guy, but he's great on that show.
He's kind of lost it, but yeah. But that's, I mean, if you're going to get someone to play an anchor or whatever, he's got the best presence in the game.
And they had, what's her name from Archer? She plays Lana. I can never remember her name. She has a great voice. She also hosted Whose Line Is It Anyway? After Drew Carey. And I know
who you're talking about. I don't know her name.
Tweet it at us. And on that note, we should wrap it up because this is going to be the longest show we've had in a long time.
Yeah.
But we will be back next week. We will recap championship weekend. We'll talk more basketball. I might talk a little baseball. All of it, you can follow us on Twitter at Calling the Podcast. And check us out online at clnsmedia.com. For Alex Lubitz, I'm Alex Barth. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.